This is Icon Art Radio, broadcasting from the swimming pool at Icon Gallery in the Cultural District of Fairfield, Iowa. And it's Donna Colby, Alan Cobb, and myself, Bill Teeple. And for those of you who listened last week, we set a quest for our listeners to find out where the swimming pool at Icon Gallery actually is. But there were some clues, weren't there? Some clues,
yes,
that sort of disturbed the show.
Well, one of the things we didn't mention is that this swimming pool, since it's been drained for safety reasons, has a wooden cover over it. So we're actually in an empty swimming pool with a wooden cover over it. And of course the wooden cover is at ground level and people can walk on it, and you may have heard some people walking over the show last week, and you may hear some more this week.
But next week we may be in a yellow submarine.
Next week we have our eye on some fascinating new venues to perform our show in.
Okay, I had a very interesting insight, which I'm familiar with, but it was brought to my attention a little more clearly by reading a portion of a book that Jim Weidel has lent me. Now I'm drawing a blank of what the author is, a well-known contemporary art critic. And he talks about a quote, he mentions a quote from Marcel Duchamp. And I realized that the two streams of contemporary art really got sent in these two directions at the beginning of the 20th century. And the proponent, the chief proponent of the one direction was Marcel Duchamp. The other comes out of the long history of art, which has to do with beautiful objects and well-composed paintings and inner dynamics of an artwork. But this one quote was very interesting to me because it brought again to my attention this one stream of art and what was happening with their thinking. It led to the whole conceptual art movement. In the 60s, people picked up on these ideas and they heralded Marcel Duchamp as the father of their art form. And conceptual art and much of the even Dada art that emerged at that time came from this type of thinking. Marcel Duchamp said, one of the reasons I believe that he broke with the impression, no, he wasn't talking about breaking so much with the Surrealists as reflecting back onto the Surrealist movement. And the leader of the Surrealist movement was the poet André Breton. And he said André Breton hadn't quite broken with the concepts of quality, composition, and beauty of materials. And suddenly, when I read that, I thought, wow, that's exactly these two opposing viewpoints that have been carrying forward since the early 20th century. And I was actually quite taken with the one in the 60s and in my early formative period in my 20s. And so I was something of a neo-Dadaist myself, living in Berkeley, California.
Yeah, me too.
And I realized that I was plugged into that thinking, that mm-hmm. actually to make something that accomplished all of the goals of that we've associated with the art object was what I was trying to not, I can't remember how I started the sentence, I was attempting to break from that tradition. Mm-hmm. So you would intentionally do something that was bad art or
anti-art.
Anti-art, yeah. Anti-beauty, and all of this was the core of the Dada movement. And I still have, so the two streams here, it's not that those guys were just being negative or being difficult. I think they found that we might call and this is why I think the beautiful has been taken out. I mean, it's out of fashion, because I think these concepts have come forward to the extent that doing things beautiful or even quality craftsmanship and this kind of thing has kind of gotten pushed aside. But to still be caught up in one's infatuation with culture and with quality, composition, and beauty of materials was to not have transcended all the way to the ultimate reality. I mean, I think these guys were attempting to, in some way, explore what's beyond all of that. And as long as you were still attached, because he was talking about André Breton still being attached, therefore he wasn't free. It was a sense of like having transcended, a sense of freedom in having come to this place. What I'm seeing, though, in our culture of today is that all this stuff got mixed up. So there isn't any clear understanding. Both these things are kind of mixed together now, and it's diluted, and neither thing is clear. I think both things lead to the same place, ultimately, in my thinking. And I've become more seduced into the love of beauty and quality and composition and quality of materials, because I've never been able to really completely jettison that.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a matter of being able to keep those two things straight in your mind.
But at the same time, you can't completely jettison that, because there becomes a new aesthetic of something that doesn't have any of those properties of being pretty and, you know,
right, but
nice
then,
material.
But Duchamp would have tried to pull the rug out from under that, too.
Sure.
And he holding on.
It's an
he was a
man.
I mean, his whole thing, and it's kind of a Zen master type of relationship,
yeah,
to the art, to the student and to culture, is constantly pulling the rug out.
Yes.
And so you have to, like, finally just be where you are and what you are.
Yeah, it could very well be an effective path. I think, when you were talking about it earlier, I was reminded of those short videos of Jay Johnson, which are, in a sense, really trying to do something just like that. They're intentionally, outrageously something or other, and yet after you've seen four or five of them, they have already established an aesthetic. And then you start appreciating them for their ability to, you know, reinvigorate that aesthetic instead of for their initial effect, which was, what the heck is going on? Oh, I see. But you can only have that experience once. And then you start repeating it. You know, and then you marvel at his skill at being able to recapitulate that.
And that's when Marcel Duchamp's urinal gets put on a pedestal, yeah, in the museum and is worth $1 million.
Yeah.
It's become an art, it's become an aesthetic in itself.
Yeah.
Well, it's just part of the natural process of growth and in art and anything else to structure boundaries, break the boundaries. And then those, like you said, as soon as you saw a few of those films, the stuff that had broken your boundaries then became boundaries in themselves. And but the fact that infinity exists in every grain of sand shows that what we were talking about last week, the importance of going deeply into your own roots and into the source of art itself, can happen in either of these categories or any category, you know, whether you're pursuing the beauty of form and composition and all that, or you're pursuing this more Zen-like thing of wanting to get away from any definition whatsoever. If you kept on going in any purely with in great, the purest of intention and integrity and persistence in either one of these directions, you would go to those same deep places and something wonderful would happen.
You might end up painting grids. Or blank canvases, or a big panel of what at first glance appears to be a color.
Well, which is why when you go to a museum, no matter what you consider your taste to be in art, you wander through the rooms and maybe you've decided that, you know, your favorite artist is Cezanne or something like that. And in order to get to the room where the Cezanne paintings are, you have to go through many other rooms of other painters you don't think you like. And yet certain paintings in any genre just grab you. And in spite of yourself, you go over and look at the painting or work of or installation or anything, and you find something in you expanding, and you find you yourself becoming moved by it, because whoever created that work of art was coming from that deep place, no matter what the exterior form is, you know, and what your thinking is about that type of art. It hits you at that deeper level anyway.
How did civilizations ever get along without having the art as an external reality the way we do?
I think I know what you're saying, but rephrase it. We have
art galleries, and we take works of art and rip them out of any context they might have had and put them in the gallery and elevate them to art with a capital A. And we put lights on them and tell people, well, come and look at that and see what it does for you or to you. And this is a very modern phenomenon that cultures didn't do before. And I wonder what difference it made not doing this, or what difference it makes doing this.
Well, I think it's a luxury that we have in contemporary society. Every culture didn't have such a luxury.
Yeah, we're not hunting and gathering all day, that's for sure.
Out there hunting and gathering and
but even in Rome, I mean, you had decorative busts of the people who were important to your family, but did they have art galleries? Did they have art
they that probably
was taken
had traders of fine objects made by human beings.
Yes.
But this thing, that there's something unique about our age, and I think it has to do with our on the verge of enlightenment kind of state, where we're able to take some, we have the ability to be some, more self-reflective, both on ourselves and on the objects and the reality around us.
Yeah.
Where we have the luxury to take a piece of it and go deep on it, you know, just in its own, like, what is the gaze that's perceiving it? I mean, we're much more able to put our attention on what is the gaze that's perceiving this thing, whatever it is, as opposed to the object being more overtaken by the object.
Well,
I don't know what I'm saying. You might explain what I'm saying to me.
At certain periods of history.
I don't think I can. I'm sorry, I was hoping I could, but...
Forget it, yeah. Okay, go ahead. Maybe you can explain what I'm saying.
Well, I'm not going to explain what you were saying. I'm just going to explain what I thought after you said that.
when you finally stopped.
Back in the, you know, before official museums, the churches were museums, and the homes of... The royalty were museums, because that's where the works of art were housed, in a context where people could gaze at them and be moved by them in a certain way. But in the churches, it was for a particular purpose, to invoke the divine through a stained glass window or a statue of the Madonna or a fresco of scenes from the Bible or whatever they did. They are exquisite works of art, worthy of anything in a museum, but they were put into this context so that those colors, that composition, that material would move people to feel more connected with the divine, which is essentially what we've been talking about in terms of getting to the deepest roots of art and life.
But up till recent centuries, it's always been some purpose
that
fit into society. And now the subject matter seems to be like art itself.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. I wonder if there was much distinction between the word art and the word craft. Whereas now there's a tremendous distinction that, you know, craft.
I don't think there was. I think this is a modern era phenomenon.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. And he didn't go to the church to see the works of someone who wasn't from the church. And those creative people, artists or artisans or craftsmen, if they were producing things, I don't know, I just imagine them as being more like product, you know, things you would buy in a store. Whereas the gallery has a, you know, we've talked about it a lot, it's sort of a temple to the creativity itself. And it's an abstraction of the creative process from living, in a way. And we've allowed it to be not integrated, you know, to be taken out of context, and that's what makes it so interesting, and that's what the urinal in the museum or the gallery was trying to draw attention to, is that, you know, look what you do when you put something in here on the blank wall under lights. You know, you're making a statement, you're not just making it visible.
So creativity itself is what it's about.
It could be shedding
some light on creativity and the creative process and what is doing the creating.
Yeah. And the idea nowadays that an artist is someone who is trying to really do something special, as opposed to an artist is someone who makes the paintings that you see in church. That, you know, it's a different role. They both do paintings, but one of them is perhaps challenging the boundaries of cultural perception, whereas the other one is you know, explicitly attempting to find the best possible expression of the culture's boundaries, the culture's perceptions.
So then, what about this distinction? Because today, we do have a great distinction between the fine artist and the artisan. And unfortunately, the fine artist is put up on this pedestal, and the even very talented artisans are often considered on some lesser level of creativity, where someone who does create a useful object, like a potter or a fine woodworker or a weaver or needleworker or something like that, can be producing exquisite works of art from some very deep place in their creative process, and yet they're put into this category of artisan. What do you think about that?
I think it's somewhat similar to the lofty position that we put philosophers in. I think that art has elevated itself to a level of philosophy and inquiry in the nature of what is reality, and this is an area of philosophy. It's kind of where it's at today. Back in the days when we had everybody was doing the Madonna, there would be someone who painted the Madonna better and in a more emotionally moving way and with finer use of colors than someone else. And I think that the lesser craftsmen would be thought of as just workers, but the one who was almost like divine in himself, in his ability to render the Madonna, took on this would be, there was something that made art fine art that distinguished it from just everyday image making, I would think. Somewhere along the line, things split off into fine art and craft.
I guess nowadays, but I think that distinction has kind of gone to its logical extreme. And maybe what we're beginning to see is that it's really the mastery of whatever creative endeavor it is that gets extolled in the gallery, or hopefully gets extolled in the gallery. And it doesn't have anything to do with what the medium itself is. So that a weaver and a potter, I used to know a potter in Vermont named Charlotte Potok, who was a fantastic potter. And I always thought of her as an artist who was a potter. I didn't think of her as a craftsman who was real good at it. And, you know, that's kind of where the fine artist distinction, like, is starting to metamorphose into simply mastery. Someone who's really good at being a seamstress is an artist at making clothing or whatever she makes or he makes with you know, sewing skills, fabric skills. But, you know, we don't have to say that, I mean, it sounds absurd to say that someone who works in oil paint is more of an artist than someone who works in clay.
Yeah, that has always disturbed me.
But I think we're living in an era where there's a kind of like PR spin that gives more importance to the people that are written up in the art magazines.
Well, there's also there's just the sheer marketability of it. I mean, this was kind of thrown in my face when I was working with Elaine Duncan trying to sell some of her works, and she had these marvelous ceramic animals. Fantastic animals, and then equally marvelous ceramic lizards, which are really stunning and I think are worth thousands of dollars. But you can't sell them as easily because people only have a certain amount of shelf space to put things on, whereas they have proportionally much, much, much greater amount of wall space to hang flat things on. So I think, it's mundane and ludicrous as it sounds, I think the form factor of the product makes a big difference. You can hang and display the painting readily. Our whole culture is organized in such a way that it's a natural and easy thing to do. Whereas if you've got a bunch of sculptures, how do you display them? You can't hang them on the wall. You have to either get pedestals and then make sure nobody bumps into them, or you put them on shelves, which kind of devalues them rather than displaying them. And similarly with other art forms, you can't, you know, show a symphony or a poem or a novel. I mean, a novel has a little bit of visibility. But a painting is a big, bold, visual thing that stands out and is easily stored in a place where everyone will find it, you know, without even trying. And I think that accounts for some of the exceptional collectability of paintings over most other graphic art forms.
But then that wouldn't explain why something like pottery, you know, because fine pottery you can store easily and bring out for dinners and, you know, have like, I went over to somebody's house for lunch the other day and they served the entire lunch on the striped Jim Shrewsbury plates. And it was absolutely marvelous to eat lunch off these fabulous works of art.
Well, I totally agree. But those plates have to be displayed in a more, I mean, it's less convenient to make those plates visible to everyone all the time than a painting. If they've got a painting on the wall, it's there whenever you're in the room. The plates, if you put them out all the time, then you don't have room for any more. And I challenge you to find an environment where you could display as many plates as you could display paintings. You know, I just... It's a, you know, sort of almost sorry I brought it up because it's such a silly reason for an art form to be in, you know, in a special position. But I think it applies to all collectibles. And one component of the art industry really is the collecting process. You can collect baseball cards. They don't take up any space. You can put them in albums. You can put coins in albums. But when you collect rocks, you have to have a room for them. And, you know, if you collect musical instruments, then you need a house for them. And some things are just much more readily collectible than others. And to be able to have it instantly perceived by your peers whenever they step into your environment means that you can use it as an expression of your sense of identity.
But painting, perhaps because of this way that you're describing, that it works in people's homes, has a it seems to be empowered with more importance.
I don't think it's painting. I think it's that it can be used like a painting. I think if that thing that you hung on the wall were, you know, constructed like a collage and had the same impact.
But it's almost a status symbol to have. There's something about status symbol have these things on your walls.
Absolutely, but that's part of what I mean. If I bought a really fine coin that's worth $17 million, I could lose it in the couch. But if I buy a $17 million painting, it'll be on the wall. You'll see it. You won't be able to go into my room without seeing it.
And there's also seems to be a bias between non-representational work. Well, I don't know if it's non-rep, but just let's say fine art and functional art. I think there is a bias towards that craftspeople.
Oh, yeah,
I think so too. That's what we're like, people who hang a quilt on the wall, as opposed to a painting. It's the same, easily collectible, easily displayed that. And yet, in certain people's minds, it doesn't fit into the category of fine art. In my mind, it would, because the quilts, for example, that Judy Bales showed in her African-American quilt slideshow were exquisite works of art.
But what I'm saying is that there's a bias. Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
And it has to do with this culture, because in Japan, a teacup could be considered the highest level of artistic expression, really at the highest level of fine art. Mm. So it's a kind of a bias of our culture, I think, that we're getting at here.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.